Sunstone presents Being Single in a Family Church, recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
On Being Single in a Family Church, my name is Albert Peck, and I'm the moderator of this session. As you can tell from reading your program, we have three panelists to discuss the issues that concern singles in the church. Let me introduce the panelists first, and then I'd like to get to some initial feelings from the audience on what they would like to have from this panel. The first panelist is Marie Cornwall, who is currently an assistant professor of sociology at Brigham Young University. She's also she's done extensive research for the Research and Evaluation Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. She is also the past president of the Society for the Sociological Study of Mormon Life. Our next panelist will be Alice Young. Alice has her degree in accounting and marketing from the University of Utah, and she has a master's degree in retail management from New York University. She lives in New York, is a mother of two children, and is a single, of course. Jeffrey Johnson is a manager of the Reference Bureau for the Utah State Archives. He is the president of the Conference of Intermountain Archivists. He's also the past president of the Utah Women's History Association. We'll hear from our panelists in that order, and then we'll entertain questions from the audience. But before we do that, I'd like to experiment with an idea someone told me about that they did with a panel once, and I'm going to try it with this panel. I'd like to have three or four or five people just briefly tell us what they'd like to learn from this symposium in 20 seconds. Does anyone volunteer just to stand up and say what they'd like to hear? This is just a little pre-assessment of our audience here. Then I'll ask some people. Okay, yes. Okay, single programs, good. Anyone else, what they'd like to hear or get out of this panel discussion? Yes. Great, thank you. The ability of members to deal with singles within the culture. Yes. Okay. We'll have Jeffrey deal with that one. Yes. Good. Anyone else? Yes.
I would be interested in knowing how the brethren are viewing recent developments, seeing some statistics, and what they think was behind the recent decision for dissolution of many
Okay. Obviously, we may not be able to answer all of these, but they give us a sense of why we're here and what we'd like to talk about. Okay, we'll hear from our panelists in the order in which I introduced them.
I prepared some comments last night, and I think I'll still read those, and then as we get into the discussions, I think we can probably, some of what I say, I think we'll address some of those questions. If they don't, let's go back and talk about those things. As I begin my comments, with all due respect to the planners of this session, I want to clarify what I think is a misnomer in the title of today's panel. The issue is not being single in a family church. The issue is being single in a married church. Single people have families. They have mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters, and many have children. The issue is not that we have no family. It is that we have no marriage partner. And without a marriage partner, without, quote, the other half, every social situation in the church is potentially awkward. This is so because one's status within Mormonism is so dependent upon having a partner. It is also true because within Mormonism, it has generally been assumed that everyone should marry and that everyone who wanted to marry could. The perfect Mormon family has been culturally defined as husband and wife who have been married in the temple and who have children living at home. At any one point in time, however, this perfect Mormon family actually accounts for less than 1 in 5 households in the U.S. church. The number and proportion of single church members has increased over the past several years. People are marrying later. The number of divorced members, particularly divorced women, is increasing. And in addition, people are more likely to live independently of their families before marriage. All of this has created some level of discomfort and awkwardness in the church that prides itself on the importance of the family. Despite the fact that Mormons are still more likely to marry than members of other religious groups, more and more Latter-day Saints are finding themselves in the single category. Thanks to a recent national media blitz, it's become common knowledge that some women may never marry. During the first week of June, Newsweek announced with utter finality that a 40-year-old never married woman with a college education was more likely to be killed by a terrorist than to be married. In a recent television documentary, After the Sexual Revolution, Peter Jennings reported that approximately 15% of all women born in the 1950s would never marry. And a University of California study has reported that if we tried to match each woman born in 1950 with a man 3 years younger, we would come out with millions of women left over. As I consider these new statistics and their implications, I'm reminded of the results of a study I read several years ago. The study reported the results of a survey of bishops and state presidents who were asked, among other things, what they thought was the solution to the, quote, singles problem. As I recall, 85% responded simply, get them married. An obviously simple answer to a very complex problem. Consider the following. There just aren't as many single men in the population as there are single women. And if the sex ratio were equal, the men and women who make up the single population over 30 are very different from each other. The women are more likely to be professionals. The men are more likely to be blue-collar workers. Single women are generally more educated than single men. And the women are more likely to live in large cities, while the men are more likely to reside in smaller population areas. All of this suggests that the simple solution of get them married is no simple solution at all. Now then, what is the solution to the, quote, singles problem? First of all, I suggest that the problem is not totally a singles problem or the problem of singles. Rather, the problem is a marrieds problem. It is a problem of married people. That is, I think it is time that we stop blaming the victim and begin to accommodate to the changing demography of our times. The first step towards accommodation is the acceptance of single people by married people. The first step towards acceptance of single people is the acceptance of the idea that some people may never marry, and that is okay. The singles problem is a marriage problem because of the way marrieds respond to single people. Let me note at this point that much of what I have to say will apply to never married people. I apologize to divorced people for excluding them, but since I cannot speak from experience on your behalf, I shall limit my remarks to the experience of the never married. It has been my experience with married people that they generally take two approaches to the never married woman like myself. There is the bold and direct approach, generally used by married men, and there is the subtle, supposedly caring approach, generally used by married women. The bold and direct approach is most often articulated within the first 5 minutes of one's initial meeting, in which the married man simply says, "How come a good-looking woman like you never married?" The problem, of course, is that not only is that the $64 million question for most never married women, It is also a very painful one. Several sarcastic replies are available, including, "Because I never had to," and or, "My husband died in the war in heaven." But even these replies do not totally take care of the problem. The underlying question implied is, what is wrong with you that you are not married? The subtle supposedly caring approach of married women is generally more gentle, equally painful, and carries with it the same underlying question. Subtle, supposedly caring married women never ask how come you never married, but make their own guesses and then begin to give helpful suggestions. Why don't you cut your hair? How about trying a new shade of lipstick? Maybe if you wore more makeup. You know, if you just wouldn't take charge so much. You know, you really ought to go on a diet. Maybe if you lost 20 pounds. Why don't you join the spa? The married problem for singles is that these approaches are not very helpful at all. They are not very helpful because they are based on the assumption that marriage is possible for all people and can be achieved by simply fixing a few things. Singles know that the problem is just not that simple. The single problem is a marriage problem because married members do not know what it is like to be single in two very important ways. First, they do not understand that the marriage market for a single person over 30 is very different than the marriage market that produced their own marriage. Because they do not understand the marriage market, they put undue pressure on singles to marry and thereby solve the problem. In fact, the pressure single people feel is a significant part of the problem because the underlying message is that being single is just not acceptable. Let me give you some examples, just one example of an embarrassing moment, which was the direct result of the need that a married person felt to pressure singles to marry. Last March, I attended the wedding reception of a friend who had just married. Yes, indeed, some never married people over 30 do get married. I was sitting at a table with a good friend who also has never married, and his date for the evening. When his home teacher approached to provide what he obviously thought was needed incentives for my friend to get married. The home teacher said, pointing to my friend's date and then to me, "What's wrong with you? Here you have two lovely ladies at your side and you still aren't married." Of course, my friend was speechless. What kind of an answer do you give in that situation? I am sure that every never married or divorced person in this room can relate similar experiences. What I want to do today is point out to married people that sometimes the questions they ask of single people are just inappropriate. Just as couples who have been unable to have children appreciate the sensitivity of others who do not pressure them as to why, single members appreciate the sensitivity of others who do not pressure them about their singleness. Second, marrieds perceive the single lifestyle as simple, unencumbered, and self-satisfying. And to some extent, I think they envy it. In fact, a single lifestyle is not so simple. Because there is no partner to share in the task of daily living, the single person must do everything. Laundry, yard work, shopping, paint the living room, lay sod in the backyard, fix the car, stop at the bank, pick up the cleaning, do the grocery shopping, make dinner, wait for the repairman at home, and earn a living too. Doing everything is particularly difficult for the divorced or never married person with children. In addition, while marrieds may look forward to a quiet evening at home, a single person who lives alone must go out to spend time with friends. To the married person, some singles appear to spend a lot of energy seeking fun and enjoyment. What they do not understand is that such activities are frequently a matter of survival for the single person who lives alone. If the singles problem is a marriage problem, then what can marriages do about it? The most obvious is that marriages must resist the need to encourage single people to marry. For the most part, single people do want to get married and do not need to be reminded that getting married is something they ought to do. Second, married people need to be less judgmental and more accepting of the single person. This means, of course, that they do not stereotype singles. It has been my experience, for example, that when a married person in my office appears tired and overworked, the assumption is that they have been working hard at their job or they've had a sixth child at home. When a single person yawns in the middle of the day, however, it is a sure sign that they were partying the night before. Finally, married people need to be more open to friendships with single people. Frequently, the tendency in the church is to segregate singles. The assumption, of course, is that singleness is a defining characteristic of common interests. Every time I move into a new ward, the response of the members is to introduce me to the other members of the ward who are also single. This in itself is an interesting response because there does not appear to be the same kind of careful attention to introducing me to people who share the same level of education, the same kind of work, or who are approximately the same age. In fact, the opposite is true, for despite the fact that I was a little older each time I moved into a new ward, in each ward I was introduced to younger and younger people. For the older single, the quality of their experience in the Mormon community is much more dependent upon their association with other married people with whom they can share similar interests than it is upon association with other single people. This is true because similarity in age and educational status are much more likely to define common interests than the mere fact of being single. In closing, let me say that I recognize that much of what I have said may have been negative and stereotypical of married people. Actually, some of my best friends are married. I value those friendships because to these people, it does and it doesn't matter that I'm not married. It matters because they understand I want to and haven't. It doesn't matter because they know that I like the way I am, and that's okay too. I've enjoyed your remarks immensely, and many of them go along with the things I say. So if you'll bear with me, I'm going to read my talk too. Classification as a single in life often brings with it a stereotype without a mate. But singles are diversified and often have only one thing in common, not being married. A stake president confided with me the other day that when the issue of a singles ward was discussed, he wondered which group to choose and single out. Young singles, middle singles, older singles, widows, divorced, those with children. It became impossible for him to choose, so he didn't. Labels can often become such barriers. I believe I'm the only divorced member of the panel, and I would like to share a little bit of me with you for a moment. I can't recall a time in my young life when I wasn't sure of my ultimate goal, to be married and have a family. The oldest of six, a serious, conscientious, obedient daughter, my young life was idyllic, much of my time spent caring for my brothers and sisters, the last three of whom were born while I was in high school and college. To my complete dismay, dating did not enter my life until nearly the end of college. A mild desperation had already set in. Graduate school, travel, teaching, and then extreme desperation. Then someone appeared on the scene who filled some of my dreams. Attractive, bright, ambitious, committed, a great guy. At this point in my life, it was close enough. A civil marriage, a way to an Eastern graduate school. All too soon, however, a sense of wrong appeared. But my love and admiration for him and my strong commitment to my goals and a certain innocence gave me hope that if I worked hard enough, lived righteously, the kind of love and behavior I had expected of him would come to me in time. Four lovely children, a great family life, and 25 years of a difficult husband-wife relationship, and the seemingly inevitable happened. After years of soul searching and trying, we mutually agreed to a divorce. My lifetime of dreams and a happy, joyous companionship and family life had been shattered. In spite of the painful agony and defeat and rejection, there was an overwhelming sense of freedom from the bondage of indifference I had endured over so many years.
This freedom gave me an energy and vitality to begin again. A new, unfamiliar life as the sole provider and nurturer for my 3 college children and my 10-year-old son. A little time for grieving, the pressure of performance and responsibility made me skim over the internal unhooking, as Mary Beth Raines describes in her article in Dialogue, Getting Unmarried in a Married Church. The next 4 years went well, however. A heavy workload with my extra time spent mainly to concentrate on my kids and their needs. However, the last 2 years, with inadequate employment, has left me with much time to think, and in so doing, I have become all too apparent that I must begin the healing process from the inside out. Now, what does all of this have to do with my membership in the church? Throughout my life, my testimony of the gospel has remained firm. However, I now realize as I look back, my internalization and understanding of the principles and ordinances of the gospel has grown immeasurably. And let me share this example. Soon after our separation, at a moment when my internal spirit was being influenced to believe I wasn't worth too much, having failed in my marriage, a tenet so much a part of the gospel plan, a very strong impression touched me, telling me, your first order of business is to learn to know and understand your true value and worth as a child of God. In other words, to love yourself as Heavenly Father loves you. This is an essential component of your ability to feel at home with your Heavenly Father. It was a tall order for me. It has taken time and patience to internalize and truly believe in myself. The events that have helped me in this process were my believing children, an incredible counselor, reading of the experiences of others, teaching the gospel, reading the scriptures, prayer, service in the temple, but most of all, the kindness and love of so many people who often, when they had no idea that they were influenced, how they had an influence on me. It is through these momentary, unexpected glimpses into our soul that brings that understanding and strength to our gospel beliefs we yearn to have. All through my marriage, I can remember feeling strongly how fortunate I was to have the gospel in the church. It gave me stability, a lighthouse, a point of reference, a safe forum for thrashing around my struggles, continuing insight and understanding as I interacted in a variety of ways with stimulating and productive people, and ultimately my temple endowments and the opportunities that ordinance embraces. I have over these last six years slowly learned to understand my earlier feelings and choices, my desperation, civil marriage, and divorce as part of a social, religious, cultural atmosphere in which I was raised. I have learned to forgive myself and know that I was doing only what I knew and understood at the moment. I also learned about the power of prayer and the infinite ways our Heavenly Father loves us and watches over us, and those incredible moments when He opens our eyes of understanding, and so much more. It all sounds so easy as I write it down, but when I recall the process, I also feel the incredible pain and confusion and hopelessness. On the other side of my church experiences, I have walked away with tears as I struggled with non-acceptance, isolation, a feeling of not belonging, being released from my calling as gospel doctrine teacher, all of the social, spiritual, and emotional struggles that go with being alone and divorced in the church, but also in the world. But these moments of aloneness were relieved by a rare, sensitive, and caring neighbor who did not see my singleness as a barrier and included me in several social affairs in their home soon after my separation. The success of this experience was based on, 1, my willingness to accept the invitation and to try to forget my difference. 2, the warmth and affection these acquaintances shared with me, and 3, the insistence of my hosts that there was no difference. I was a friend, and they loved me. Singleness, it seems to me, should not be a divider. We are, first of all, brothers and sisters, and as such, need to serve each other. In so many ways, the church has done so much, but there will always be much more to do. As I have prepared this message, I realize that there is another entire arena of service I have not yet addressed.
It would have been a lot easier if you had mailed those questions to us before we prepared. I feel a need to introduce myself in saying that my experiences are from the point of view of a never-married male and that has a certain set of experiences and certainly doesn't represent all in that category. 3 years ago, I wrote an article for Exponent 2, and so if you hear some of the things that you read, you might have read them there. Last night, I looked over that article and updated a few things and will use that as a basis for what I want to talk about. Basically, what I've done is picked out 3 areas that I think are particularly difficult for never-married males. And to convince you of that, I'm going to give you some examples and not tell you how to deal with them, but I have some observations about my single experience that I'd like to talk about after that. The 3 areas are, I think, it's particularly difficult for never-married males to deal with their families. I agree with Marie that we do have families. Deal with the church. And then deal with sexual stereotypes. One of the greatest difficulties a single man must deal with is with his family. When I was quoted in the Deseret News article about single people during the holidays and saying that advantage of being single during the holidays was that I could decorate my Christmas tree the way I wanted it, my mother was very hurt. That statement, she felt, denied the value of a family. She is overtly sensitive to my enjoyment of my lifestyle. Both my parents have communicated in many indirect ways the pain that my singleness causes them. They somehow believe they have failed me. Somehow they have been a bad example. This is very difficult because I think that's not true. Because our society views marriage as an introduction into adulthood, singles are treated like perpetual teenagers by their family. And frequently they act that way too, I'll have to admit. Although I served a mission and graduated from college and have a respectable career, my mother, who lives in southern Utah, still worries if I can get my clothes ready and packed for my business trip to Chicago next week. Dealing with the church. In addition to being considered rebellious about church counsel to marry and irresponsible for not having done so, single men must face questions about his worthiness. And this is an example to prove that point. The former counselor in my ward, Bishopric, with whom I had worked as executive secretary for over a year, asked me who the new bishopric of our neighboring ward was. I knew the names of the bishop and the first counselor, but I did not know the name of the second counselor, but knew he had been their Sunday school president and that he was single. My friend was aghast. He said, "I can't see why they would choose someone like that for the bishopric." Now, all he knew about this person was that he was single. He didn't even know his name. Of course, I wondered if he thought I was worthy for the position that I was fulfilling in our own ward. The home I grew up in has been a great help. Serving and volunteering were a part of the air that we breathe. I've always held positions that made me feel an important part of every ward I've lived in. And I recognize this is not true of all single men. It is probably true, however, there are some positions my bishops have never considered me for because I am single. Many church leaders today feel that single men are not worthy of some positions. My research shows that almost every position in the church has been held by a single man. There's been single stake presidents, single high counselors, single bishops. Joseph Smith called single men to serve in the original Quorum of the Twelve. 3, dealing with sexual stereotypes. Some people equate singleness with homosexuality with alarming speed. I've always considered myself above that concern, but when a friend who was separated from his wife moved into my house for a few weeks and eventually disclosed that a divorce was eventual because he was gay, I panicked. I started immediately worrying about what other people would think about me instead of thinking about him and how to help him. Some single men date women compulsively and a lot just to diffuse the suspicions about their sexual orientations. It is ironic that of the 6 men I have known that have declared a homosexual preference, only one of them was single. One of the most painful experiences with my singleness took place when I was Sunday school president in a struggling branch, where one teenage boy, obviously in need of attention, was systematically dismantling his class. I involved him in some of my church assignments, showed interest in his schoolwork, and noted with pleasure when he stopped being a discipline problem. Just when I was feeling pleased with his progress, the branch president told me that his parents didn't think I should be spending so much time with him. He said, "After all, you're not married, and they're afraid." I talked with the father, but it did no good. If I had been married, my interest in the boy would have been happily accepted as genuine concern. I had to stop working with the boy, and his behavior rapidly reverted to his old destructive pattern. I probably resented this stereotype as much as I've ever resented anything, particularly since the boy could only read my change in behavior as yet another rejection. I think as I've studied historical single men, I think that they have not had to deal with this problem that current contemporary single men do. Everybody lately is interested in sexual orientation, and that becomes an issue with a lot of people lately. Okay, my observation. First, and maybe this answers some of your questions, I feel like the church programs support the idea that singles are perpetual teenagers. I think that's in general. I've had a lot of experience in single programs and singles wards, and that's the conclusion I've come to. One reason is they're planned without input from those who the programs are for. I once asked why there were no single men on the general boards. There are single women. I was told that single men were not worthy to be on the general boards. I think this attitude is common at church headquarters. And as long as they don't respect the people they're planning for, these programs will not be successful. I know that there are singles that are used to plan singles conferences, but my experience says that there is always a struggle with the advisors over what singles really need, and usually the advisor's perception wins out. It's very difficult to give feedback to the general church. I've enjoyed my years in the singles ward, but I think they tend to keep people from getting on with their lives. There are a lot of playing around and waiting to get married, then you can start your life. Singles without children have a hard time seeing time passing. One of the things I like about my resident ward is that I see children growing up and people getting old. These are things I never saw in my single ward. Second observation. I think it's very important that singles develop a support system. Although I enjoy my work and keep busy in my academic pursuits and being the gospel doctrine teacher in my ward and belong to several study groups, I find there are times I need someone to talk to. It is important that you have someone to let off steam to and to share a triumph with. In my case, the support groups include friends, both married and single, male and female, as well as older people in my ward and some children who are part of my life. The children seem especially important to me right now. They include my own nieces and nephews and grandnephews, children in my ward, and children of friends. I have two friends that are raising children as single parents, and they let me share in this little activity. Number three, I think one of the most important sources of my identity as a single man has been my search for historical single men. I made a sort of pilgrimage to George Washington Carver's birthplace in Missouri. He was a single man who made important contributions to our society, and he has inspired me with his good work. Mormon culture has been influenced by single men. The first president of the University of Deseret, John Park, never married, but yet had a great influence in church and education in Utah. It's interesting that he developed an interesting support foundation, a support group. He adopted during his life five orphans and had this family that he had created. Evan Stevens, who died a bachelor, spent his life directing the Tabernacle Choir, writing music, including more hymns in the hymn book than any other author. He expressed always his joy in the gospel. Knowing that these and other single men have made great contributions to the church, I have had a desire to do that same thing, and that's helped me in giving me a solid foundation in the church. Thank you.
We answered some of the questions, or had some responses to some of the questions that were raised, but not all of them. Unless any of our panelists want to add anything to what they said in response to some of our other panelists, let's open the discussion up to questions from the audience. Yes, in the back.
Feel how
to Brother Luke's question about the doctrine of the being single.
That's still about that a woman who never married cannot achieve the same, call it what you will, exalted salvation as if she did. Is that still formulated by the male, of course, but it's still there.
Okay. Who would like to respond to that gentleman's question?
Let me respond to Theron's first. As I understand, the feeling now is that women will in the hereafter be sealed and will receive salvation, and women don't have anything to worry about. Well, to anybody they want. Right.
Some sex on you.
Well, I'm not a doctrinal expert, but I understand, no, you cannot receive salvation unless you're sealed to someone. But especially hard for single men because most church leaders teach they don't have another chance. But women always have a chance, and someone worthy of them will be there waiting for them. But men are damned if they don't make this choice. The way I deal this in my gospel doctrine class is I would say there's a lot of doctrines in the church that not all of us are living, and we're all striving for perfection. But there are other doctrines that I bet there are people in your class that people aren't living either. Well, that's why we have Sunday school, isn't it? To teach us the doctrines. Does that make any sense? It doesn't, okay. It doesn't. That's just the way I would have. Well, I don't know, Theron, because the male are under greater condemnation than women. I mean, the experience, a woman can be here and just choose not to marry, and everybody assumes that that she'll be saved anyway if she's righteous. Men don't have that choice.
Okay, other questions? Yes, that lady there.
Just the extent to which we accept diversity within the church. And I think singles are in a funny bind in terms of that too, particularly singles who live in areas where, for example, there are singles wards. Now, I know there was a question about singles wards before we started. My experience is that at a certain point I said, gee, you know, attending the singles ward is not doing anything for me. I don't think this is where I should be. So I made a decided effort to say, I'm grown up now, and I want to spend time with the grown-ups who are in the church. The grown-ups are married people. Rejected by the singles because you decided to go to a resident ward, and rejected by the resident ward because you've decided not to go to a singles ward, and in essence have given up. Part of it is kind of, I think, that the members themselves have to be more open to the fact that individuals have to basically be in control of their lives and make decisions about what would be best for them, and that we not judge about those decisions until we have more information.
Yes, miss.
Yeah.
I think that answers your question, because what the church should do is do nothing. But what they're doing is doing things that make us feel that way. And so what they need to do is treat us like everybody else. I mean, we don't have programs for people with blue eyes or people who's left-handed or anything like that.
See, but one of the things I think we do is that we have all these different organizations in the church that are responsible for people. We have the Relief Society, Melchizedek Priesthood, you know, the Elders Quorum, the High Priest Quorum. One of the funny things that happens is that, for example, in many wards, single women over a certain age are the responsibility of the High Priest Quorum. I had one experience, for example, in the ward that I live in now, where after having been there for a year during my during an interview with a bishop, I said, "You know, Bishop, you ought to have some activities in this ward so adults could meet one another." He said, "Oh, we did. We had one last week. Where were you?" And I said, "What was it?" He said, "It was an Elders Quorum party." And I said, "Well, I'm not invited to Elders Quorum parties." Within the next month, I got a call from the Elder Quorum's president's wife. And see, I didn't know her. I was still fairly new in the ward. Having lived there a year, for a single person, you're still fairly new. It's very difficult to, you know, to meet people. She called me the night before the party, was very nervous because she had no idea, obviously had talked for a half hour with her husband about how to call this single woman and invite them to an Elders Quorum party that no one knew. And I had plans, you know, for the next night already. And I haven't heard anything since. So part of it is that, now I had just the opposite experience in a ward that I lived in Minnesota, where the Elders Quorum president, aware of the problem, one of the differences there was that there were a lot of divorced women, a lot of women who were married to non-members, and then there were some women who, like myself, had never married. And the Elders Quorum president saw to it that we were all invited to all Elders Quorum parties. And he announced them, he called us to make sure we were there, if we needed rides or whatever. And he didn't feel funny about it. But part of it was numbers. The more that there are active singles, and I think I was one out of 20 not married people over 30 in our ward that was active, which gives you some idea of what the problem is. But the more single people there are in a ward in terms of critical mass, the more aware that the leadership are that there is this group out there that needs to be addressed.
Yes, sir.
This is shifting gears a little bit. I realize it's kind of a sensitive topic, but I appreciate you handling it a little bit more. I know throughout the country there are a number of single people who are feeling the need of having their own family, having their own children, through either adoption or artificial insemination. Within the church, single individuals might even apply for adoption through the church. And we know, of course, that the statement of the brethren indicates that artificial insemination is not acceptable. What is your perspective on fulfilling that need? Not being able to have a marriage, of course, but then having that intense desire to have children, to raise a child in the home. And what is the general theme that you see within the circle of the
Well, I'm sure Alice has comment because you have children, right? Let me just say, I have friends who have adopted, and it's been a very positive experience for them. I don't have any problem with the fact that the church doesn't allow single people to adopt, mostly because they can't fill the requests as it is of people. I have considered adoption myself and at this point have not done it, mostly because given the demands of my work, I at this point I do very well to take care of my dog, who can handle himself fairly well and only needs a bucket of food every night. So and needs me to be home at some time within about a 10-hour period to let him out. So but I think it is an option for some women. The one example of a friend of mine who did adopt, one of the differences it made for her was that the people in her ward discovered her. That once she had a child, there was a connection. She had something to talk to about with the other women in the ward because she had a child that needed to go to the various primary courses, classes. She was just connected more. So I think it's a viable option.
Does anyone ask any questions here? I can't see the hands. Yes, sir.
I'm the bishop of Singapore. They didn't come out too well.
Salt Lake. Where is it located?
I've thought a lot about this and been involved in some studies on that, and I came out negative in the paper. Like I say, I enjoyed my ward when I was there, but I think we should think through and see why we have singles wards. Most people believe we have singles wards so singles will get married, and I don't think that's true. I think they'll get married, you know, without the singles ward. People who are going to get married get married, but if these singles are having a hard time dealing with their home wards, you know, I think we need to confront some of those problems of why we have them. And in Salt Lake, there's so many singles, it isn't so singles will get to know each other, but there might be other places they need to do that.
Well, I just wanted to say, I don't think we're all saying they're full of adolescents. That's a little bit too strong. I spent several years in first a BYU student ward and then in a singles ward when I moved back to Salt Lake. And it was a very gratifying experience for the time period. I think that they fulfill a very important need for singles, particularly singles under 30. I think the damage of a singles ward is that they begin to... that the current policy basically throws people out of the singles ward at the very time when they're experiencing the most anxiety about being single. I think that period from probably about 28 to maybe 32, at least in my experience and with my experience with other single friends, that age, 28 to 32, is so painful. And then for, you know, you'd be called in by your branch president and say, you just had a birthday and you have to go. I would hope that we have a little more compassion than that and that we spend, you know, some time. Eventually, I believe that most singles will move out on their own. The problem is that there are some who cannot do it on their own. And I'm the first to admit that I think there are single people out there who could benefit from some good therapy. And I feel like I can say that because I did it myself. And that therapy is not doesn't take place, I don't think, in the bishop's office. I think the bishop can deal with some spiritual matters, but in terms of some real issues about commitment, some of the maybe pain of childhood or whatever can get in the way of forming relationships. But all I'm saying is that period from 28 to 32, particularly for women, I can't speak for men, is a critical age, and you know that we need to be more sensitive to those people who are working out their life stories that doesn't quite match the story that they were always told.
I want to respond to the singles ward. So I just finished being elders current president of a singles ward in the Washington, D.C. area, where up until a year ago, there were five singles wards in that metropolitan area. And the demographics of the singles in the Washington area, they're primarily yuppies, you know, who graduated from school and are working for the federal government, either in Congress or, of course, one of the executive agencies. There's a great... I'm sorry. My sense... Pardon? It's not working? Okay. My sense, first of all, when we heard of the church announcement about limiting the ward to 30, because the vast majority of the people who are young people in their career are over 30 and they're singles there, there's just total disregard of the policy in Washington, D.C. And it's a very conscious thing that we've worked out a very tentative relationship with the brethren so that they're overlooking it. But... There are. I can't think of any men who have gone to a family ward. Although in our ward there are probably five or six women who are in their mid-30s have decided they don't want to play with the single scene, so they go to a family ward, but they want to remain on the ward mailing list so they receive the newspaper and know of the activities, because they still want the association, and they maintain a lot of their friendships with the singles. But I think it meets a real need, particularly in terms of assimilating the number of people who move in and in reactivation. They come into the ward and they have a community and they want to do things. They don't have a family to go home to at night. And they need to meet people who they can go out and eat with and go to movies with. And in terms of helping inactives and people who are struggling, people who don't have the whole life together, a singles ward is very helpful in that. Now, the Washington, D.C. stake just came up with a new innovation. I don't know how successful it will be, but they eliminated their singles ward and they created the Chevy Chase ward, which is for all singles in the stake, and it is for everyone living within the boundaries of that ward who are older, like in their 60s, or who don't have children. So the ward is designed not to serve the needs of the youth. If you have children in primary MIA age, you have to go to a different ward. So the demographics of the ward are, it's young singles and it's old widows or old couples. It's a curious ward, but that's how the stake is trying to deal with it. There were a lot of hands. Yes, back in that corner.
How did you feel about your friend so that you talked about the issue of having there being a call for that to visit the church or for dealing with these kind of issues with being single church, etc. How did your friend respond to this? I don't mind what your friend may have been or offended, but maybe there should be something different in that experience for you and other people.
Most of my friends have left the church, basically.
Yes.
Thank you.
somehow nearer to God when you were single. You may remember that. It's a reflection of that holy rest. It's striking, it seems to me, that today, a single person in the church that you described as Latter-day Saints is a pretty distinct disadvantage for the many reasons. I believe that people are very miseducated. It just seems to me that you might something to reflect on. Obviously, we speak so from the standpoint of a never married female, a divorced female, a never married male, a divorced male, whatever. But it seems to me that you run the terrific risk of simply driving people out of the church if they are constantly labeled and patronized and hidden. Most of us really don't feel all that faithful. And we do not particularly appreciate being patronized. And the Doctrine and Covenants, notwithstanding, you have to make a few. It just strikes me that, and I'd like to reflect upon that, perhaps come to that ultimately for all those who are single in a married church. Can the church come around simply treating as many other Christian communities among us do, all of us as worshipful and worshipful communities?
Can I just add to that? I'm glad you mentioned the divorced man. I think the divorced man has the greatest discrimination, and you don't see many at church. It's mostly because it is so difficult for, I think, them to maintain any kind of activity, whether or not the divorce was his fault. That is just personal. I've always wanted to have children, but I've never had a strong need to go through the birth process. So I'm not sure that's a big deal. I think I'd be much more, and I mean, if I do it that way, I mean, it's interesting the church's pronouncement because, I mean, if I had a strong need to actually experience the birth process, I think I'd much rather experience the sexual part of it than just have the artificial insemination, since that would be more interesting than the birthing process. So, so basically, I think it's out of the question, particularly since I'm employed by the church. So.
I do have
unless
a friend.
Someone would support me for a year.
I do have a friend who made that choice, and she's had two children that way, and feels like the church made that statement because of her situation. The statement was after she was pregnant, but it's after the insemination. So I don't know. There are people who are making that choice, and Perry.
And they're disciplined, and then later they come back and they're full membership, and they have their children.
Yes.
I think you've sort of sparked something in my mind too. I'm not sure that the big problem is this, in that it says you have to be married. I think underlying that is the assumption in the church that the marriage experience itself gives the people involved added experience that someone who is never married will never have. And I believed that for a long time. I remember a discussion years ago I had with a friend at the Lion House. In fact, I have this image of a bright sunny day in my head where she said, the problem is that we're going to fail because we're denied certain experiences. I don't believe that anymore. I mean, I've experienced plenty of those experiences, and as I've made contact and established more married friends, I'm completely comfortable with the fact that I've had plenty of experiences that will qualify me for whatever blessings there are, whether or not I actually married. Oh, I should do that.
Loud.
The assumption is whether or not an intimate bond requires a marriage partner or sexual intercourse. I think it's very, you can have a very intimate relationship with another person without marrying them or without ever having sex with them. And I think we need to give credibility to that.
Yes, ma'am.
On being married in the past 20 years has overshadowed
sabbatical never hurts.
What?
A sabbatical doesn't
hurt. No, and I don't think that hurts. I'm not saying that.
Well,
I agree with you.
What I'm taking, but also I'm trying to take it. And the new release, Manual, is going to emphasize spiritual, too. And everybody has to have two spiritual instead of one, or maybe none. And I'm hoping that they will begin to meet the need of a diversity in the church, which includes the majority of the single women, for whatever reason they're single.
I think this is particularly true about single men needing to hang in there and staying, because I think the perception is that the single problem in the church is a female problem, and that the single men are not there, they're evil or they're gone. And so I just want to say that I encourage the idea that we should be there, we should be in those discussions, and we should talk.
I just want to say one more thing that's been very successful for me, and that is that I was called to teach the mother education class, and it became very apparent that we had two groups in our ward, the young mothers who were moving back into this neighborhood, and we had these older women and young single women. And I would get up to teach the mother education lesson and realize none of that information was really going to be pertinent, except perhaps as an auxiliary idea, and a grandmother, an auntie, or whatever. And I have had wonderful experiences with these sisters as I have taken the core of the material, the idea, the kernel, and developed something that would approach them. And the response from them has just been really gratifying. So I have been grateful that in spite of my singleness and awkwardness and uncomfortableness at times, I have hung in there and kind of said, it's okay to speak out and to encourage, because the bishop who cannot deal with me at all, I mean, he's so uncomfortable with my divorce and the life I live, and I love him, he's a great man, but he just is not comfortable, and I had to just overlook that and be comfortable with him.
There's a gentleman over here.